You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 27th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ada Ferrer, professor of history in Latin American and Caribbean studies at New York University, author of Cuba and American History. Also on the program today, tonight, the Senate will attempt to fund the government and lift the debt ceiling, and Republicans will obstruct it. And then what happens, we'll see. Meanwhile, corporate Dems fail to force the vote today. Progressives' threat to vote against the tiny infrastructure bill will delay its vote. More on that in a moment. Meanwhile, CDC report consistent with new studies, masking helps in pediatric cases in schools with no mask wearing. They rose faster. U.S. claims enough vaccines to give boosters and to kids ages 5 to 11, the latter of which may come within just a couple of weeks. Meanwhile, a federal judge delays the vaccine mandate for New York City teachers, and New York State may see a hospital worker shortage because of vaccine mandates. Former CIA chief Mike Pompeo apparently contemplated both kidnapping and assassinating Julian Assange back in 2017. Ostensibly because of the Vault 7 leaks that WikiLeaks published. German election results are in. Leaves a weakened center-right party of Angela Merkel, but not necessarily a more powerful center-left. Meanwhile, Joe Biden looking to run a migrant detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. New York Times report rise in poison control center calls regarding ivermectin. Meanwhile, two New Mexico deaths attributed to patients refusing anything but ivermectin to treat their COVID. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Happy Monday, the beginning of what we're anticipating will be a bit of a crazy week when it comes to wheeling and dealing and lawmaking. And with me for the entire week, Emma Vigeland.
Yeah, I'm here.
And she's just trying to power through, folks.
No,
the Giants did not have a good weekend.
And I was at the game. I paid money to watch the Giants go 0-3, and I will admit that I cried in the parking lot for like 10 seconds, 15 seconds, 1 minute. But I'm not wearing blue in solidarity. I'm wearing it in mocking.
I understand.
In parody.
I understand. This is very difficult for you.
Actually, I love work today. This is what's wonderful. I can just talk to you, and we can talk about politics in order to take my mind off of that. Like, genuinely, there needs to be some sort of intervention that
I'm
someone hosts with me.
No, it definitely feels like there needs to be an intervention.
Yeah, I'm having an issue.
The name Gottheimer, but in the Giants font.
Right, there you go.
I mean, that's going to be in my nightmare tonight, but thank you. Thank you for the image.
let's talk about this, because there's an interesting thing that's going on right now. Obviously, tonight we have the Senate is going to be voting on the continuing resolution to fund the government for 3 months, and a lifting of the debt ceiling. Mitch McConnell has vowed to block this by filibustering. The debt ceiling, of course, could cause the first default in the history of the United States. There is a plan B. The plan B is to later in the week, just hours before the government is to stop running, that would be the government funding bill, would be to bring up a clean version of that bill, just the government funding, dare the Republicans to vote that down. They more likely will not. Nobody likes to be blamed for a government shutdown. And they will move the debt ceiling into the reconciliation bill. Now, the interesting thing about that is that makes it a little bit harder to vote for against the reconciliation when that comes up. And so arguably, it gives a little bit more opportunity for the progressives to leverage it. However, on that side, something else is happening. So about several weeks ago, 9 corporate Democrats in the House insisted with Nancy Pelosi bring up a vote on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. This is the tiny one. On this day, Monday, September 27th, that will not happen today because Pramila Jayapal, the head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, says that she has almost 60 votes to vote against it. Pelosi has pushed it to Thursday. Meanwhile, how do you get progressives to vote for that? There's talk that she may bring up some type of reconciliation framework bill, or maybe they can get enough public vows of support from some of those corporate Democrats. Here is Josh Gottheimer, one of those who has been pining away for a reduction on the salt tax deductions cap on Jake Tapper's show.
That's why I know we have to get it done, and we will. And we also have to get reconciliation done, and that's also going to get done.
Well, you know the answer to the question. The reason that it's not going to be voted on tomorrow is because House progressives are worried that more moderate Democrats such as you or more conservative Democrats like Senator Joe Manchin will kill the reconciliation deal, the Build Back Better Act, if they don't make sure that it's a quid pro quo. They will vote for infrastructure. As long as you vote for reconciliation. Let me just ask you, though. Go ahead.
No, I just want to be clear about that. I support reconciliation. So, and so do my colleagues. You know, we meet all the time. And let me tell you, we all agree that we need a reconciliation package. And I think that's important for everyone to understand. But that doesn't mean these are two separate bills, right? You've got infrastructure and historic once in a century. There's no reason why we shouldn't pass that right away and get those shovels in the ground and make sure we can do everything we can to stop, you know, derailments and invest in our infrastructure and climate and make sure we fight climate change. And then also we should keep working on this separate bill on reconciliation, which I'm committed to passing, you know, and
right.
As Pramila said, we're talking all the time to make sure we can get that done as well.
Yeah.
The agreement was that they were going to be passed together, and he knows that. But he supports reconciliation in theory, right?
Like
he
reconciliation bill.
Just like the concept of reconciliation. I'm totally cool with that, man.
Well, yes, there will be a reconciliation bill that is going to be passed. The question is exactly what is going to be inside it. And yes, this guy also knows that that was the deal. The deal was pass them at the same time, period, end of story. That was the deal. And he's also a liar in terms of everything else he was saying regarding his support for climate change legislation.
Bigger reconciliation package, the more comprehensive ones, although Manchin's taking a hack at that as well.
But here is the rub. We saw Axios reported that, and it's unclear to me how they articulated this, Representative Vincent Gonzalez from Texas and Fileman Vila from Texas, excuse me.
It's okay.
it chokes me up a little bit to talk about this.
Well, it gives me an opportunity to say Gottheimer on the Problem Solvers Caucus, more like the Problem Creators Caucus.
Indeed. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
They said they support the $3.5 trillion reconciliation package. So they were specific with the number. But the bottom line is, and it doesn't matter, Gottheimer, Case from Hawaii, Kurt Schrader, Jared Golden, Carolyn Bordeaux, they can all, and there's a couple others, say they're for the reconciliation bill. But the problem is this. If you pass in the House the bipartisan bill without passing a specific reconciliation bill, then you are giving license to Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema to hack away at it, to take out everything.
To
they
keep
don't
working
like.
At it, as
exactly.
Said.
So the reconciliation bill needs to be a bill. It needs to exist before the progressives, and there's some non-progressive caucus members too, because everyone understands the value of this.
Because Biden himself understands the value of this. This is the president's agenda, which is like normally what you know these kinds of moderate lawmakers are supposed to be on board for. But they see value in doing this for, like, Gottheimer specifically, the SALT deduction. He wants to represent his wealthy constituents in his district, and that's the exact reason he's holding up the entire Biden agenda. Sinema has her own option, or her own incentives as well. I mean, now she's saying she doesn't support raising the top marginal tax rate and repealing the Trump tax cuts. That's how conservative this woman is at this point. They all have their own separate kind of trade groups and industry groups that they're appealing to.
The bottom line is they are going to have to hold the line in the House and vote on no bipartisan bill until the Senate is done with their reconciliation bill, because that is where the leverage comes from. It doesn't matter you pass a reconciliation bill if it only has $800 billion worth of funding. You have missed the opportunity. And if the debt ceiling is going to be in that reconciliation bill, the pressure then starts going to Kristen Sinema and to Joe Manchin, because then they're in a position of tanking essentially the world economy.
They don't look like the reasonable deal makers if they are responsible for shutting down the government.
Well, this isn't shutting down the government. This is the debt ceiling.
Sorry,
this is about not the U.S. government, for the first time in its history, not meeting its obligations, its debt obligations. And now that can play out well into October. And I think we should have the progressives force that situation. We do have a deadline, and that deadline now is going to be the debt ceiling for reconciliation, and progressives should keep an eye on that. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Ada Farrar. She is a professor of history and Latin American and Caribbean studies at New York University, author of Cuba and American History. We'll be right back after this.
Which one is it? Caribbean?
Yeah. Okay. Folks, speaking of which, well, I guess this really isn't speaking of this. We do have cooler weather that's coming in. Mm-hmm. We're not in the Caribbean or the Caribbean. So you don't think too much maybe of dehydration or signs of overheating or perspiration. Well, it also is that time where maybe you might start to have Christmas holiday parties, or just to it gets to be fall. I'm going to start drinking a little more. Maybe that's I don't know if that happens. Look, the bottom line is Liquid IV. I tried to segue into it. Didn't go through.
I was in very hot weather yesterday, hotter than expected at the Giants game. Got a weird sunburn as soon as I came back. Liquid IV, had a beer or two, and it was hot.
I should have just started with my week too.
Yeah. Right.
Because on Thursday, I had an esophagram, which is an unpleasant experience. It involves drinking barium.
Oof.
I'm fine. But they were like, don't get dehydrated. Make sure that you drink a lot of water. Maybe you want to get, some type of electrolyte drink. And I said, I'm covered. I believe me. I've got so much liquid IV. I've got it in my backpack. I've got it at my home. I've got it at work. I'm covered. And, of course, every day for work. One stick of liquid IV, 16 ounces of water, hydrates you faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, liquid IV tastes great with flavors like watermelon, which I am featuring today.
That's a good one.
Strawberry, lemon lime. I've had others, pina colada, the matcha with the energy. If you're enjoying a few extra drinks, maybe you're doing a little air travel, you're feeling a little sick, you want to stay hydrated, don't want to get the flu or whatever it is, Liquid IV contains five essential vitamins, more vitamin C than an orange, and as much potassium as a banana. They also have the immunity support tangerine flavor, which I like.
Oh, nice.
It's healthier than sugary sports drinks. No artificial flavors, no artificial preservatives, less sugar than an apple. The optimal ratio of glucose, sodium, and potassium delivers water and nutrients into the bloodstream. The company has donated over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. Products are being donated to hospitals, first responders, food banks, and more. Check it out, folks. I read a piece in the Times the other day that the maybe it's not the Times. To stay hydrated, it's not just about water. It is about those things like potassium and sodium. And right. That's why Liquid IV is so efficient. Well, the Times didn't write about that, but that's what I've garnered. Grab your favorite Liquid IV flavors nationwide at Walmart. You can get 25% off, though, when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MajorityRep at checkout. That's 25% off anything when you order and when you get better hydration today using promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Other sponsor of our program today, been sponsoring this show for quite some time, years, in fact. Maybe you're heading back to the office, time to get that fresh, clean, all-business look. That's the kind of look I like to have on Mondays. However, didn't do it this week. But generally, when I do, it's with Harry's. If you don't know Harry's, it's time you do. Harry's was created to be a different company from other shaving companies. Harry's crafts high-quality, long-lasting blades and durable weighted handles that make a close, comfortable shave quick and enjoyable. Since Harry's insists that you shouldn't have to choose between a great shave and a fair price, they just give you both. Refill blades start as low as $2. New Harry's customers get their starter set, which includes a 5-blade razor, a weighted handle, foaming shave gel with aloe, and a travel cover. That's a $13 value, and you get it for $3.
Wow.
Harry's also offers a wide range of amazing face and body care products for men, all delivered right to your door. Body wash is excellent. I use the shave gel as well. But for me, ultimately, it is the razor. I like the simple design of their handles. I like the narrowness of their blade head. From my asymmetrical nostrils, Harry's has been great to me. And, you know, I'm not a big shaver, but when I do, it's with Harry's. That would be a weird pitch for them, but I don't know.
Well, all right.
There's never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/majority to get their starter set for just $3. It's 100% satisfaction guaranteed. So guess what? You got nothing to lose. Go to harrys.com/majority right now to get this special offer. That's Harry's, H-A-R-R-Y-S, harrys.com/majority. Okay. Want to welcome to the program Ada Ferrer. She is a professor of history in Latin American and Caribbean studies at New York University and author of Cuba, an American History. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. And Ada, please, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Ferrer. That's fine.
Ferrer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Apologies, but
yeah.
Thank you for joining us. And I have to say also, in addition to your book being a really very comprehensive history of Cuba and Cuba's relationship to America and as told the experience of the people, your piece about your brother in the New York, I found to be really just heartbreaking and fascinating. So thank you for that. And maybe we will talk a little bit about that in a moment. But let's start with why an American history?
Yeah, the book could have been perhaps just Cuba, a history, but I decided that sounded kind of flat. And also, the history of the two countries are so intertwined that any history of Cuba is also necessarily an American history, because the U.S. has played such an outsized role in the history of the country. I also feel really deeply that it's, and maybe this partly comes out of personal experience, but also out of intellectual and political commitment, that I think it's good for people and nations and to see the nations to see themselves sometimes from the outside in. The U.S. acts on the world in many places. It's useful, I think, for Americans to get a perspective on the U.S. that comes from those other places where the U.S. has played such a role. So I call it a history of Cuba that also serves as a kind of shadow history of the U.S. It's not a full history of the U.S. It's selective, but it does also reveal something essential about U.S. history as much as Cuban history.
And to that end, I was really fascinated, and I was not sort of aware of this dynamic, although it makes, once you understand this, it makes a total sense. But that it feels like from what you've written, and maybe we can go back a little bit earlier than this, but that Cuba's trajectory was dramatically impacted by the Haitian independent revolution. And you know, which in and of itself, the Haitian revolution was obviously a hugely, it was a massive piece of sort of moment in history that also impacted the trajectory of that country, particularly in the context of its relationship with the United States. But talk about the interplay of those three countries at that moment.
Yeah, well, the Haitian Revolution occurred in what was then the wealthiest colony in the world, French Saint-Domingue. So the wealthiest, of course, for the people who held it as a colony and for the people who owned land there. So there, the enslaved people rose up and eventually eliminated slavery and declared independence from Spain. Cuba is very physically very close to Haiti. And because sugar planters in the French colony were so wealthy and so powerful, Cuban planters always wanted to be like them. And so when the Haitian Revolution, you know, introduced all this turmoil in the colony and sugar production dropped, Cuban planters said, this is our chance. The hour of our happiness has arrived. And it's in that moment and in response to those events that sugar and slavery and the slave trade take off in Cuba in a definitive way. And it's going to mark the rest of the 19th century in Cuba. And some of the patterns would persist much longer to the era of Fidel Castro. In terms of the U.S., the U.S. famously acquired something like a third of its landmass when Napoleon decided to sell part of France's territory in North America. And he did that partly to, recover funds to fight in the Haitian Revolution. So the Haitian Revolution had an enormous impact in the U.S. in terms of just territorial expansion. And Cuba likewise held enormous appeal for early American statesmen like Jefferson and Adams and Madison, who really saw the U.S. as becoming a larger country, a more powerful country. And they wanted to acquire Cuba because they thought, you know, there's all these quotes from these 19th century founding fathers about how the U.S. could not reach its full potential until it acquired Cuba. And I think Americans are just surprised to hear that. Why would Cuba have been so important in the 19th century that they felt the need to acquire it? And I mean, I can expand on that.
Please.
Yeah. So I think a part of it was commercial, that Cuba is located in this very important geographic spot that sits at the intersection of the Atlantic Ocean, the Caribbean Sea, the Gulf of Mexico. And if you look at a map, Cuba is kind of below where the port of New Orleans sits on the Gulf of Mexico. So Jefferson and others were worried that anyone who controlled Cuba had the right to block American commerce, that they could blockade ships coming out of New Orleans and headed to Europe, to North America, to South America. And so acquiring Cuba was a way for them to protect their commerce. And, you know, again, you think of New Orleans, it was a major port in the 19th century. All the food grown, the wheat, the corn, everything else in the Mississippi Valley went out through that port. And right near where Havana stood. So they saw the acquisition of Cuba as very important commercially. They saw it as a way to expand American power internationally. And also increasingly, the U.S. was invested and implicated in Cuban slavery. And they were worried that if Britain somehow acquired Cuba, Britain was by then against the slave trade. It had abolitionism. Abolitionism there was very powerful. So they were worried the British would come in to Cuba and the slave trade, eventually end slavery. And all these American investments in sugar, in slavery, in the slave trade, eventually in the railroad and other things would be threatened. So they attached a lot of importance to that connection with Cuba.
It's amazing to me how the entire, I guess, history of the United States' relationship with Cuba has just been defined by, is Cuba going to be a threat to capital or a threat to capitalism in general? Of course, with the rise of Fidel Castro. I mean, the United States' response to that, I think, is indicative of this larger dynamic. I found it really interesting how you wrote about how the U.S. kind of seized on the opportunity at the turn of the 19th century into the 20th century to take credit for the Cuban Revolution. And I mean, they were successful in securing Cuba for their own interests for a small period of time. I wasn't aware of how opportunistic they were to that extent. I'm wondering if you could expand on that part of our history, because that was so fascinating to me.
Yeah. You know, when we're in high school, maybe, I don't think we studied in elementary school, we all kind of learn about Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders and the Spanish-American War and the explosion of the Maine and all that. And so that's an episode that Americans know as the Spanish-American War. U.S. declares war on Spain. They go to places, they go to Cuba, they go to Puerto Rico, they go to the Philippines. And in about 4 months, they defeat this old European power. And that vision of history ignores this really important, fascinating period, which is the Wars of Independence in Cuba, which had begun 30 years earlier. So ostensibly, the U.S. intervenes in 1898 against Spain to help Cuba achieve its independence. But Cuba had been fighting for that independence and mobilizing and advocating for it for 30 years. They had the movement had created a multiracial army that was profoundly popular and that eroded social distinctions to a great extent. It championed a vision of racial equality that was startling for the fact that it emerged out of a slave society. And some of the leaders, principally Jose Martí, who was killed in the war, also saw Cuban independence as a check on American expansion. So you have all this going on for over 30 years. It's the third year of the war in 1898. Things are kind of at a stalemate. Spain is able to hold the cities, but it can't assert itself in the countryside. And the Cuban rebels, the independence fighters, really believe that independence is within reach and that they can win it before the end of the year. And it's at that moment that the Maine explodes and the U.S. comes in. So the way that moment is remembered and narrated after the fact in the U.S. is as the U.S. acting benevolently to help a neighbor achieve independence. And in that vision, independence, Cuban independence, is seen as a kind of gift of the U.S. to the Cubans. But in Cuba, it's seen radically differently. And that is that Cubans had been fighting already for 30 years. They had almost won. And the U.S. intervened and then used that intervention to establish a longstanding power. So they occupied the country militarily for 4 years until 1902. The highest official in the land was an American governor. They wrote the budgets, appointed people, et cetera, et cetera. And then they left eventually on May 20th, 1902. But they had a condition. The U.S. had a condition for its departure, and that was that the Cubans accept something called the Platinum.
Oh,
Oop, the Platt Amendment.
We have, we're frozen. Bradley, can we get,
basically,
I'm sorry, professor, I'm sorry. We froze just as we were getting to the Platt Amendment.
Okay.
But before we actually, which was fortuitous, because before we get to the Platt Amendment, I want to go backwards here a little bit, because, I want to get a sense of what happens during the 19th century when we have the Haitian Revolution happens. There is there's an opportunity, at least from a business standpoint, of, I guess, sort of capitalists and slave owners in Cuba to sort of take advantage of this business opportunity, since a big supplier of both sugar and slaves.
Right.
What becomes the United States perspective? Like, I mean, how do you go from, like, in the early 1900s, well into deep into the 19th century, when Jose Marti, and who is considered to be more or less a founding father of Cuba, what is that development there, and how much U.S. influence is there? What gets built up that it takes 30 years? You know, is it just simply the what are the forces that Marti is fighting against throughout that, and when does that fight begin during the 19th century?
Yeah.
How much of it is the United States, you know, saying, like, we can't have another Haiti here,
right,
because this is going to send the wrong message, at least, you know, for the first half of the 19th century, this is going to send the wrong message to our slaves. And, you know, we need the sugar.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, the U.S., and they said this, American officials said this explicitly, Cuba cannot be independent because it will become it will become a black republic, another Haiti. We'll lose our investments in all these things. But what they thought was, so they thought about purchasing it. Sometimes they thought about whether it was worth going to war for. But their decision for a lot of the 19th century was that as long as Spain was a relatively weak power compared to Britain, say, or France, or even the U.S., as long as Spain was a weak power, the U.S. could live with that because it could keep developing its interests there. Spain was eager to retain Cuba, so it gave Cubans the right to trade with the U.S. So the system more or less worked for the U.S. Increasingly, especially after the 1840s, after the U.S. has, you know, after Florida has been acquired, after Texas has been acquired, many people believe that Cuba is the next logical step. And that is all about slavery. So propertied white Southerners saw the acquisition of Cuba as a way to protect slavery in the U.S. So the idea was that they would incorporate Cuba to the U.S., annex it, it was called, so it was U.S. annexation, and they would convert the island into perhaps three slave states, which would greatly increase the power of the South in Washington, D.C. So that was the vision. There were what was called filibustering expeditions that left out of places like New Orleans to try to wrest Cuba away from Spain and then attach it immediately to the U.S. So that was kind of the mood and the consensus among the most powerful Americans in 1840s, 1850s. And, you know, even on the eve of the Civil War, you had the slave trade as a booming business, even in New York City, where ships were leaving New York City, going to the west coast of Africa, and then selling their cargo in Cuba. But after the Civil War happened, then that position lost a lot of power, because what was the point? You know, once slavery no longer existed in the U.S., what was the point of acquiring Cuba in that moment? They would have to liberate the slave forces in Cuba. So annexationism kind of declined in that moment. And that's when you have the rise of the Cuban independence movement of people like José Martí or the Afro-Cuban general Antonio Maceo. Martí always saw the struggle as one that was against Spain, But he knew, he used to say that there were people who preferred that Cuba never be Cuban, that it be Spanish, that it be American and not Cuban. So he said in one of the last letters he ever wrote that he saw the challenge of that moment being, he thought that the greatest need was to avoid that Cuba, on becoming independent, would allow the U.S. to kind of spread its wings over Cuba and then into the rest of Latin America. So he always saw Cuban sovereignty, which was always his goal, as something that had to be won from Spain and protected from the U.S.
And he was 100% right.
Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. I mean, he was exactly right. I mean, that takes us up to the Platt Amendment in 1901, which is really an amazing piece of legislation because Cuba is not America, a United States, I should say, at that point. But somehow the U.S. Congress felt like we can legislate this. I mean, tell us about the Platt Amendment and clearly. I don't know. I guess, you know, I don't know how apocryphal the whole, like, you know, the Maine, the story about the Maine is as to whether, you know, what caused its sinking, or, you know, Randolph Hearst saying, you know, I'll get you your war type of situation. But clearly the United States was waiting for two sides to fight it out and then basically to step in. And at the very least, how that control exerted itself, they weren't quite sure, but they clearly were going to control this situation when there's only one person standing.
Right. Absolutely. So the Platt Amendment was, you know, written in Washington. And it's interesting, when the U.S. first intervened, part of the reason that Congress voted for that war and that intervention in 1898 was because of something called the Teller Amendment, which recognized that Cuba was free and sovereign and that the U.S. was going in just to protect that Cuban sovereignty momentarily. And once everything was pacified, they would leave. The thing is, the benchmark kept changing. So then Cuba was pacified actually fairly quickly. And so the Cubans said, okay, it's time for you to leave. And they're like, no, you have to prove yourself capable of self-government before we leave. And that became the new benchmark. So there were elections and all the elections were peaceful, but the people who were elected were the most pro-independence types, not the kinds the Cubans wanted. So when they proved themselves capable of self-government, it changed yet again. And that's when the U.S., Platt and the War Secretary Root, et cetera, basically said that the ultimate proof of Cubans' ability to govern themselves was to accept the Platt Amendment as an appendix to their new constitution. And, you know, so the Constitutional Assembly met, they talked about it, they voted against it once, they voted against it twice, but they realized that the Americans would never leave unless they approved it. And so that's what happened. Now, what is the Platt Amendment? Well, it basically gives the U.S. the right to intervene militarily in Cuba without being invited in. The U.S. could determine when life, liberty, and property were in danger in Cuba, and then it could decide to intervene. It did other things as well. So it limited the ability of the Cuban government to incur foreign debt. It limited the ability of the Cuban government to sign treaties with countries, you know, other than the U.S. It also earmarked land for the development of naval stations. And that's the origin of what.
We have another. All right, we will hopefully she'll be back. Oh, I'm sorry. Professor, I'm sorry. We lost you again, right?
I'm wired into the connection. I don't know why it's doing that, but
it could be a Zoom thing, but you were saying that we had you just at the moment where the idea that they could intervene and that this was the you know, going forward, that the US had these sort of ability to dictate whether Cuba had loans from other countries, ostensibly to develop themselves. I mean, this is the United States basically saying, like, we'll control the pace of development. We'll control the freedoms that you have in the country. This is the United States wresting full control from the Cuban people. Professor?
Yeah, you froze for me, but I'm okay, back.
You're back. Yes.
Sorry about that. So, yeah, and, you know, Leonard Wood, who was the U.S. governor, said Cuba has no real sovereignty under the Platt Amendment. It was just a stated fact, and that's what.
Okay, we have just a little more technical difficulty. Bear with us, folks. Maybe we'll have her reconnect.
Yeah, sorry.
There you go. You know, I think maybe the best thing, maybe if you just switch off and then reconnect.
Leave the meeting and then come back?
Yes, that'd be great. And Bradley, will you hit the timer for us? And we will bear with us, folks. We're having a little bit of technical difficulty, and we should have it resolved in a moment. Okay. Yeah. So we'll try this again. And so you were saying, though, this is a the United States exerting just about every bit of operational control over Cuba as you would want if you were concerned about maintaining sort of hegemony over Cuba. Right. Like it's. Yes. You can do what you want in the house, but I control your credit card and I own the car and, you know,
a conservatorship, if you will, which has been in the news a bit recently.
Yeah. And the naval base has created Guantanamo Bay. And this becomes the new sort of like new normal for Cuba. What develops as a function of that? Maybe we should try it without camera. Okay, so we're back, and apologies, folks. We're having a little bit of technical difficulties, but we are now recounting the history of Cuba, and we are somewhere around the beginning of the 20th century, and there has been an amendment to the Cuban, I guess, charter or constitution that has come from the United States. It is named after a senator from Connecticut, which is not part of Cuba. The Platt Amendment basically says that Cuba has sovereignty, but not over the primary functions that a government would need to really develop and to strike out in the world as an independent country. What then happens over the course of the next, I mean, really, I mean, 40, 50 years in terms of Americans, in terms of America, but also just in terms of Cuba and the way that it develops?
Yeah, well, that's a long period to cover. But one thing that happens repeatedly is that the U.S. intervenes. So there are other military interventions. There's a full-scale occupation, 1906 to 1909. There's others in the decades that follow. What the Platt Amendment means in terms of Cuban politics is that it's hard for a really independent domestic politics to take shape because everyone has to, leaders have to take into account what the U.S. government is going to think of X or Y. It also means that when you have competing parties in Cuba, that one of them, let's say there's a contested election. If the party that's out creates enough trouble and creates the semblance of chaos, that could get the U.S. to intervene to put the winning party out of power. So it's hard to have a truly functional sovereign politics under the Platt Amendment. So that's something that is unfolding in the political sphere. You have American ambassadors who are exerting, you know, incredible control over domestic policies. One famous, really hated one, Enoch Crowder, for example, you know, would appoint the cabinet, or not appoint, but he would tell the president who to appoint in his cabinet and so on and so forth. So that's going on politically. Economically, the U.S. is acquiring more and more property. And by the 1920s, the U.S. controls about two-thirds of the Cuban sugar industry. The sugar industry is the backbone of the Cuban economy. It's their main export. Most of it is owned or controlled by U.S. corporations and U.S. banks. So that means that any profits from Cuba's primary industry are going overwhelmingly to American companies and individuals. So that's happening economically. Culturally, you have more and more ties between the two countries. You have more American tourists traveling to Cuba, particularly, you know, with prohibition in the U.S. They can't drink in the U.S., so they start going to Cuba to have, you know, rum and beer and all kinds of things, and to dance and gamble, which also becomes legal in Cuba and is not in the U.S. So you have that kind of connection develop. But really, I just want to say one more thing. It's really important because there's a way in which you can talk about Cuba as this kind of playground of the U.S., say, and people talk about this in relation to the mafia, for instance. But it's important to note that Cuba has this, a vibrant political and intellectual scene that, as the U.S. is exerting control, there are Cubans who are mobilizing against it. They're writing against it. They're creating parties and independent associations to combat it. So and we can't lose sight of that. Cuba is more than what the U.S. makes or doesn't make of it.
There's a paradox here because there's no stifling of dissent within the country until it achieves a level that would ultimately perhaps threaten U.S. Interest in particularly in the sugar trade at that point. And just to be clear, the U.S. sort of interest in Cuba at that becomes more exclusively about resources than it does sort of the military perspective of needing a beachhead to protect, let's say, New Orleans by the time we get into
right.
Although, you know, that's going to change at one point when 20 or 30 years ahead. And so
right.
Increasingly, the U.S. also, I would imagine, begins to support the idea of, you know, more or less a dictator in Cuba, because that's the best way to ensure that the deal that we have is secure, right? We don't have to worry about the vagaries of a potential democracy, inhibiting our sugar interests.
Well, that's a really interesting and important question, and it comes to a head in the late 20s and early 30s when you have this president of Cuba, Gerardo Machado, who's originally elected as a reformist candidate. He doesn't want to leave office, and he gets increasingly repressive and brutal with the opposition, and the U.S. supports him. Until the very end, when they realize he can't maintain control. But if you look at that period of, you know, beginning in the mid 20s, excuse me, historians sometimes call a nationalist awakening in Cuba, because you have all these intellectuals, students are an incredibly important political force in Cuba, lawyers, feminists, activists, Black veterans, they're organizing, they're critiquing the dictator. You have sugar workers on strike. You have massive strikes across the island in the 30s, and you get a revolution against Machado that defeats the dictator. And it's at that point, after that revolution, that the Platt Amendment is abrogated. It's much more complicated than that. We can go into it more if you want, but what you saw in that example is that the U.S. was willing to abide by Machado's dictatorial policies until it became clear that Machado could not maintain the peace, that the sugar estates were burning, that the workers were constantly on strike. And at that point, the U.S. could see clear to not supporting Machado anymore.
Right. You don't want to be on the losing side if you're and I mean, and it feels like this, that story plays out over and over again. I mean, it's not that dynamic's not terribly different than the than Martí's independence from Spain, and then from Machado, and then we go into a period where, you know, I guess the United States is just sort of like hoping and betting and probably prodding, and then ultimately takes us up to Batista. I mean, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but not too much. And Batista comes in as presumably a, you know, it comes in as a democratically elected president, but that evolves into a dictatorship as well. And when it becomes clear that Castro has led a revolution for a couple of years that is successful, the United States sort of takes a similar tact. Like, well, yeah, we were sort of always for this anyway. Yeah. Level.
Yeah. I mean, but Batista's a fascinating character. And, you know, Americans, if they know about him at all, they know about him as the man deposed by Fidel Castro. But he'd been a, you know, an important, you know, more than a figurehead. He'd been the man in Cuban politics since that revolution in the 30s. So he was involved in that revolution. But when that revolution became too progressive, it started, it nationalized some American properties. It always sided with the workers. Batista was head of the army, and the U.S. ambassador worked with Batista to undo that revolution. And that's the rise of Batista is directly linked to the U.S. role in Cuba. So Batista becomes kind of, he doesn't become president at that point. He's head of the army, and he's the man behind the scenes, making sure that that progressive part of the revolution is quashed. Then he is elected democratically in 1940. His successor, there's no re-election at that point. His successor is defeated. You know, his presumed, you know, the person in his party who he presumed would be his successor was defeated at the polls. And then Batista is running for election in 1952. He's running third. He's going to lose. And basically he stages a military coup that, that gets rid of the government, suspends the the constitution, which at that point is a new constitution from 1940 that did not have the Platt Amendment in it. So it's at that point in 52 that he takes power as the leader of this coup and this dictator.
And so we can see, you know, over the course of a history of at this point, I guess, you know, over 100 years of the United States inhibiting the growth of a culture of, you know, or at least the, I guess the sort of like, because clearly a culture of democracy there and a culture of, you know, I don't know that it was necessarily named as socialism, but of certainly of like, of equality and of, communalism, and the United States sort of periodically stepping in to make sure that that's not growing. And so the sort of what begins as sort of a populist revolt under Castro, it feels like there was some type of sort of inevitability to that. And it was really the United States just stepped back and waited to see where the chips were going to fall.
Yeah. So there is this important tradition in Cuba that is both socially progressive and anti-imperialist. So it wasn't necessarily communist. It wasn't always socially, but you think of like a social democratic tradition, and what you saw most powerfully in the 1940 constitution that was written. It had all these social provisions, like, you know, the 8-hour workday, maternity leave, all these things that you associate with socially progressive causes was part of that constitution. And it was also very anti-imperialist and pro-sovereignty. So there are important politicians in that vein, important thinkers, and Castro comes out of that tradition. So sometimes, you know, we think of Fidel Castro, this tall bearded guy in the mountains, as if he came from nowhere, but he's very much comes out of Cuban political traditions and history. And when, you know, the U.S. supported Batista right until the very end, They withdraw military support a few months before he loses power. And they, after the revolution comes to power, they recognize the new government within days. I think it was less than a week or about a week where they officially recognize the new government. And then they just watch really carefully to see, you know, what's going to happen. And really, they don't know what to make of it. They don't know what to make of Fidel Castro. They don't know, you know, they keep, and it's fascinating to read the memos. They're like, is he communist? Is he not communist? And everyone is saying something different. He's not communist. He's anti-communist. And he's a, someone says, you got, he's like a volcano about to erupt, someone says. So, yeah.
And really the decision that he's faced with on some level is, the devil, you know, or maybe the devil you don't, in terms of if you were interested in Cuban sovereignty, you knew that the United States had, you know, at least a century's worth of examples of like not going to allow that to happen. And so the only other option there was the Soviet Union at that time.
At that time, yeah. So initially when Castro is asked about, you know, is he communist, is he socialist, he always says no. Some people say that that was just strategic. He couldn't admit it at that point because the U.S. would have attacked right away. But I do, I mean, there's a debate about this. Was he, when did he become communist and all that? We can, if you want, we could talk about that. But I think it's important that initially, publicly, he's constantly trying to find a middle path. And so he says, it's not, the only ism is humanism. This is a humanist revolution. It's not red, it's olive green, like the, you know, the army uniform of the of his rebel army. We want, what would he say? We want the, we want bread without terror. Bread meaning, you know, we don't want the worst of communism. We don't want the worst of capitalism. We want bread without terror, justice, etc. So that, that, you know, so that that's the language that is most powerful for a long time. And then the U.S. starts to bandy about the communist charge more concertedly after May of 1959, which is when Castro, when the new government enacts an agrarian reform. But actually, it's a pretty moderate agrarian reform that they enacted. But, you know, any agrarian reform that confiscates very large landholdings is going to necessarily confiscate some American landholdings because the U.S. companies own so much there. And that's when you started to get communism, the charge of communism take off. And by November of 59, you have Eisenhower say, we can't work with him. We have to find a way to get another government in there. So it's pretty quick on the U.S. side.
And then you know, Castro has one option. If he genuinely is committed to a sovereign Cuba. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll come back and we're going to skip ahead. Folks should really read your book. And when we come back, we'll just talk about, you know, what we can anticipate now in a Cuba that is now led by someone who's not Castro for the first time in 60 some odd years.
Yeah.
We'll take a quick break after this. We on break? Okay, so we just got to, we'll come back and, yeah, and yeah, we'll wrap up relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Okay, we are back, and we're skipping ahead to over the years of Fidel Castro and his brother, I guess, also for a couple of years. We just had protests in Cuba. Where, like, what is the situation in Cuba now in terms of the freedoms or lack thereof that people enjoy in some instances? You know, there's a lot to be that we're skipping over in terms of like a lot of the gains in terms of literacy and medicine, and the ability of people to live in housing. There's also been a lot of political repression over these years as well. Where are we now, and where do you anticipate things going?
I'm a historian, so I'm always going to take you back. There's no way to understand where we are now unless you understand the effects of the fall of the Soviet Union in Cuba. So basically, from the early 90s, you had this horrible economic crisis that just changed daily life in Cuba. And in some ways, the government dealt with that by increasing tourism and allowing foreign direct investment, things like that. But really, the country never recovered. And so we're 30 years into that. So the economic situation never recovered. It's worse now with the pandemic, which has had a horrible effect in Cuba of late. And you have growing repression. The repression's been there pretty almost from the start. And the new president, Díaz-Canel, has given no indication that he's going to let up. In fact, it's been the opposite. So he's put in new laws, really limiting artistic expression. Artists can't exhibit or perform unless they have express approval from the government. Some young artists have called for negotiation. Some cultural figures wanted to do that. The president said, nope, no negotiation. They're all terrorists. And then we saw it after the protests, which were unprecedented. They occurred all over the island, more than 50 locations. Many young people, many Black Cubans, many artists and so on. And the president went on TV and basically said they're all terrorists. They're paid for by the U.S. And he sent people out to crush them and beat them and arrest them. So the political situation is terrible. And I really think that a majority Cubans are 30 years more tired of economic crisis. They're 30 years more tired of being told to wait and of having to sacrifice. And I think the new president does not have the historic relationship to the country or the people that the Castros did. And the majority of people don't trust him to know how to overcome the deep crisis of the present.
It's fascinating stuff. I wish we had even more time, and perhaps we'll have you back for to cover those years and to get a sense of where we're going, the special period, as they call it, after the fall of the Soviet Union, and the military, the economic deprivation, and of course it's enhanced by the embargo from the United
States. Right, absolutely.
Significantly. The book is Cuba, an American history. Ader Ferrer, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, if you're watching us on Peacock, we will say goodbye until tomorrow. And if you're still with us, we'll say hello and we'll head into the fun half. I mean, it is really amazing. Just sort of like we could probably have a variation of that interview about Haiti. Many ways would be
a lot of the patterns reproduce themselves.
Guatemala, Nicaragua. I mean, there's, you know, some places it becomes more murderous, our involvement. You talk about like the legacy of decisions that we made in this country and of our imperialism from 200 years ago. It's not a lot you have to do 200 years later if you do it right the first time, in terms of like making countries really inhibiting the development of self-governance.
It's the good neighbor policy.
Yeah, I mean, you only have to intervene a couple of times before you ensure that these countries, you know, back in the day, if you do it enough, or whenever there's a inkling of some type of democratic control or impulse, if you do it enough, you can really screw up a country for decades to come.
Right. Right.
So, congratulations to us. Congratulations to us. I would also argue probably that there's that to the extent that you can do that with like sort of the culture of democracy, you probably also can do that with like, you know, sort of cohorts of people. like the, you know, implications of slavery in the context of where you then also have like a series of rolling initiatives to continue to keep a lot of people as second class citizens.
Yeah, and then you can just change the justification every time, right? It's communism. It's trying to stop a tyrant. It doesn't matter. You can
right.
You can just interchange them. Pick one of them out of a hat. Although the they're not too creative with the imaginary boogeyman.
Well, you don't need.
I guess you can just
play the hits. The hit was this guy is a threat to democracy, and by democracy there's a little asterisk that it says the interests of global capitalists.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
I've told this story before, but I worked on my then wife's I guess she wasn't my wife at that time documentary that we shot in Cuba in 2002. And one of the subjects was one of Castro's photographers, who Castro understood that he was dealing with a country that was had a high illiteracy rate at that time before Castro came in. They have a very high literacy rate now. And so he wanted to tell the story of the revolution in pictures. And this one guy, Raul Corrales, who I believe has since passed, I would imagine he must have traveled with Castro in his first trip to the United States to speak at the UN. And apparently Castro's CIA nickname or security nickname, Sugar One, gives you a sense of what the who he was to the United States. All right, folks, just a reminder, it is your support that allows this program to survive and thrive. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show, and then you get extra content almost every single day. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie. How do you sign up for it? You go to majority.fm, scroll down to the bottom, insert your email address into the insert your email address insertion place. You write it in there. And that's that. Also,
the insertion place.
As I mentioned the other day, our Discord has over 4,000 members now.
Wow.
It's a great place to go to discuss stuff on the show. It's a great place to go for resources. It's a great place to talk with other people in the community. We lost somebody in that community over the weekend. EJ, who would post as Negan's cat. And she passed away. She was very, very supportive to a lot of people. And so I just wanted to offer our condolences to her family and friends.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Rest in peace.
So you can join that community by going to majority discord.com. And join the folks over there. It really is, there's been people who have been following the show in one form or another over the past 15 years. And and over that time, we've lost people who are big commenters on the blog at the old Majority Report radio blog that we had back in the day and others. It really is a wonderful community of people, and real friendships are developed, and a lot of, not institutionalized, but mutual aid is offered to people. And so, you can be a part of that as well. Don't forget, you can check out Nomi Show, youtube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. You can find that also on Twitch, twitch.tv/the_NomiKey_show. And Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
For patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We had Dominique Remy on, @CanaryFilmmaker, reproductive justice advocate. We talked about the Texas anti-abortion stuff, including not only SB8 but SB4, which is a bill to ban mail-in drug, basically mail-in drugs by mail, which is interesting coming from a state where, you know, Matthew McConaughey, who's been silent about all the abortion stuff, starred in a movie about crossing the border to get drugs that weren't available. So we talked about that, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We also talk about Dominique's upcoming the film that she's working on. So check that out, folks.
All right, quick break. Head into the fun half.
Is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.